Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Donald Trump is scheduled to speak at a predominantly African-American church in Detroit this weekend, the latest in his push to raise his abysmally low poll numbers among black voters. The Public Policy Polling Group released numbers just yesterday that found that 0% of black voters view Trump favorably, I should say. The margin of error there, plus or minus 3%. That's a major problem for the party of Lincoln as a whole, of course. And Trump admitted as much last Saturday in Iowa.
Republicans are the party of Abraham Lincoln. Pretty good president, right? Pretty good. I said, I'm going to be the most presidential president you've ever had. And then I thought about Abraham Lincoln. And I said, well, I don't know. He's pretty tough to beat, right? Abraham Lincoln, he was pretty good. But that is a great Republican, which brings me to a subject that is so important and very personal for me. Nothing means more to me than working to make our party the home of the African-American vote once again. Used to be.
That's Donald Trump on Saturday in Des Moines. But making the GOP the home of the African-American vote once again would mean that in the next 10 weeks, Donald Trump somehow manages to reverse a political trend that's lasted more than half a century. Leah Wright Regoor has written extensively about that history. She's a professor at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government and author of the book The Loneliness of the Black Republican, Pragmatic Politics and the Pursuit of Power. And she joins us now in the studio. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Oh, thanks for having me here.
It's great to have you. First of all, I just wanted to play another piece of tape from Donald Trump speaking recently about African-American voters. This one is probably a little more familiar to listeners, but I think it sort of sets the stage for our conversation. Here he is a little earlier this month in Michigan appealing to black voters.
Look, what do you have to lose? You're living in poverty. Your schools are no good. You have no jobs. 58% of your youth is unemployed. What the hell do you have to lose? And at the end of 4 years, I guarantee you that I will get over 95% of the African-American vote. I promise you.
We should note that even President Obama in 2012 only won 93% of the African-American vote. But Leah Wright Regoor, Donald Trump's tone and word choice aside, this appeal of you know, his claim that African-American voters don't have any better place to go, or that the Republicans are their best option, has that been tried before?
So it absolutely has been tried before. And just before, you know, we just get into it, you know, you have to acknowledge that in terms of pickup lines, what the hell do you have to lose is one of the worst things that you can absolutely say, in part because it opens the door to saying, well, actually, this is what we could lose. Mm-hmm. Now, outreach has been tried. Every Republican presidential candidate, you know, dating back pre Barry Goldwater 1964, but every Republican presidential candidate since the big switch in 1936 has done outreach to African American communities. Now, some candidates have done a better job than others, but they've all still done it. So the idea that, you know, that outreach hasn't been happening is a false one. The problem is that the outreach that's been done has been pretty shoddy.
Shoddy in that it isn't backed up by policies that are fulfilled, or that the choice of language has been suspect.
So all of the above. So, and that may sound like hyperbole, but it's not. There's one of the biggest things that leads to a divide between African Americans and the Republican Party is the belief that African Americans have that the Republican Party just doesn't care about them. And just to give you an example of this. In 2015, about 88% of black voters surveyed said they believe that Donald Trump did not care about issues that mattered to them. And that number is actually held steady for Republican candidates over the last 30 years or so, where black voters will say, this candidate simply just doesn't care about my issues. And so long as black voters believe that the Republican candidate does not care about them or the party doesn't care about them, they will not support them. And so we see that black voters will say things like, the Republican Party has been insulting to me. The Republican Party does not care about the policies that I'm concerned with. And the Republican Party won't even do things like coming into my neighborhood and talking to me. So this has been an issue of contention that has gone on for a very long time, with a lot of frustration, both outside of the party within black communities, but also within the party amongst those groups who are interested in actual reform.
Now, I want to definitely get to that point because it's a really interesting one. But if we could step way back in time, because in your book, The Loneliness of the Black Republican, I mean, it was absolutely a fascinating read. And
thank you.
And there was, I mean, when we talk about the party of Lincoln, let's you know, be honest here, because you quote, for example, you know, no one less than Frederick Douglass, who at one point in time, in an article that you wrote, said he had said the Republican Party is the ship and all else is the sea around us. I mean, Frederick Douglass, right? So, but then, of course, you mentioned you talk about in your book, and you just said it now, that a great shift began. In 1936
roughly,
or so,
yep.
36
roughly
or
1936.
So, with Roosevelt, with FDR, right? So can you tell us what happened there? What were the specifics that started pulling black voters towards the Democratic Party?
So the answer is both simple and complicated. the simple answer is that race and economics really shift African-American partisanship during that period. So on the economic sense, Franklin Delano Roosevelt's New Deal programs, many of the New Deal programs, include African-Americans in addressing the very real need of poverty and inequality. Now, this is not necessarily deliberate. In fact, many of these programs include African-Americans by virtue of being colorblind. And in fact, other programs exclude African-Americans because of race. With that said, Eleanor Roosevelt plays an incredible role in the symbolic value of the White House during this period, where she is photographed with African-Americans, she invites African-Americans to accompany her, and she is instrumental in pushing for African-Americans to have a voice on New Deal agencies and organizations. So we begin to see this rapid shift out of the Republican Party, to whom African Americans had been loyal, and into the Democratic Party coalition, the New Deal coalition, roughly around 1936.
Okay, but then as soon as 1939, the GOP itself realized it had a long-term problem on its hands. I mean, it commissioned a report that found that, I mean, it sounds like it happened back in 2012, but it happened in 1939, right? That as long as it tried to aggressively woo white voters, it was going to have a long-term problem with black voters.
Right. So the idea behind this is, in fact, for the audience, they should know that Ralph Bunche, the Nobel Prize winner, and, you know, the diplomat and the political scientist, very famous civil rights activist, actually writes the report in 1939. And one of the things that he does is he's highly critical of the New Deal for these racial blind spots, but he's also highly critical of the Republican Party, where he says, if you continue to go after Southern segregationists and white voters, you will alienate black voters forever. And he says, you cannot, I think the phrase is, you cannot hunt with hare and hound, you cannot have both, that you either have to be for civil rights or against civil rights. You can't try and play both.
What prevented the GOP at the time from fully embracing that message?
So I think the commitment, the interesting thing is that both parties are struggling with committing to civil rights. Right? It's a reflection of the time and it's a reflection of the era. In particular, I think the Republican Party is going back and forth amongst itself saying, well, can we be committed to civil rights in the way that black voters need us to be? This means being aggressive on issues like voting rights. This means being aggressive on issues like economics and fair pay or equal and equal access to employment, on ending desegregation in the armed forces and across industries. And so there is a lot of hedging, and you see in the actual report that is issued that the party actually says, well, here, we really like these parts, but we don't like these other parts. Mm. And the parts that they really don't like are the ones that take that seem to involve doing much more in terms of federal involvement than the others. And the problem, I think, with this is that they're also measuring this against the possibility of winning or moving Southern segregationists into the Republican Party at the same time.
Okay, but to be perfectly fair, I mean, the Democrats aren't wearing a halo during this
time at all.
I mean,
not.
I mean, they have an extreme segregationist wing that cost
Correct.
Them, you know, at least a couple elections at least, right?
Correct. So the interesting, this is where it gets complex and messy. We also have to remember at the same exact time, we have a great migration going on. So African Americans are moving north. And as they're moving north, they are forming alliances with Northern Democrats who realize, hey, wait a second, we can form a coalition, a winning coalition by working with African-American voters. So when we do see black voters in the South, remember, many of them don't have the right to vote. When they do have the right to vote, they're voting Republican. So much of this split that we're seeing does break down on partisan lines, but also geographic and regional lines.
Mm-hmm.
So Southern segregationists are still very much a problem within the Democratic Party well into the 1960s, whereby, in general, when we see African Americans support the Republican Party at higher levels in presidential elections, it's because they are punishing the Democratic Party for the segregationists that are still within their midst.
Such as in 1956. I mean, 40% of African Americans voted
right.
for Eisenhower?
Right. And so 56, there are a number of things that go into this. The Republican Party has put forward a civil rights platform. Brown v. They're still reaping the rewards of the 1956 Civil Rights Act. And then on top of that, the Southern wing of the Democratic Party has reacted viciously and violently to Brown v. Board of Education and desegregation. And so black voters, those black voters that support the Republican Party, are really punishing the Democratic Party for not being able to control its segregationist wing.
Well, I'm speaking with Leah Wright-Rigour. She's a historian and professor at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government and author of The Loneliness of the Black Republican. Leah, this brings us to the Great Switch, as you've mentioned it called, 1964. And it was, the Great Switch was precipitated by this.
Let our republicanism, so focused and so dedicated, not be made fuzzy and futile by unthinking and stupid labels. I would remind you that extremism in the defense of liberty is no vice.
That, of course, Arizona Senator Barry Goldwater accepting the GOP nomination at the Republican convention in California in 1964. Now, it was a series of events that coalesced around what Goldwater's campaign meant, which really had this transformative effect amongst African-American voters in the United States.
Absolutely. So this is a watershed moment. This is the moment in this election where 6% of African-Americans support the Republican presidential nominee. So it's a wide just separation of a group that could be previously could be at least consistently counted on to give a quarter or one-third of its vote, of the electorate's vote, to the Republican Party. Now, Goldwater is interesting because he really launches a campaign in the early 1960s that is premised around the idea of buckling down and pushing down on conservative values. And he says, you know, these are constitutional, these are principled ideas. But a large part of what it boils down to is the difference between states' rights and civil rights.
Mm-hmm.
And now, if you're a black voter during this time and you're watching Goldwater's rise, this is deeply troubling. This is concerning because this is not about, okay, constitutionalism, principled ideas or individualism or kind of all of these what we might call semantics. But instead, I am a second-class citizen, and you're now suggesting that the states should control whether or not I have full equality. So we have to think about, you know, what does that mean in Mississippi? What does that mean in Louisiana? What does that mean in Alabama? And then what happens is, even after Republicans form part of this vital coalition to pass the 1964 Civil Rights Act, the most comprehensive Civil Rights Act that the nation had seen up until that point, the party then turns around and nominates the senator that votes against that very act, which is Goldwater.
I mean, he had called it unconstitutional, but it also said that if it becomes law, that, you know, he wouldn't oppose it as official U.S. law. But yes, you're right; he did indeed vote against it. I mean, and it was just soon. It was soon thereafter with Nixon's campaigns, where you know, many people look upon that and say, look, there we're seeing the full fledged use of race as a political strategy amongst the GOP. And in a way, I have to say, I think Richard Nixon, effectively or not, I mean, I'd like your opinion on this. He faces that head on in the 1968 Republican convention, where in his nomination acceptance address, he actually talked about whether or not his law and order approach, which he so heavily emphasized in his speech, was racist or not. Here's what he said.
And to those who say that law and order is the code word for racism, there and here is the reply. Our goal is justice. Justice for every American. If we are to have respect for law in America, we must have laws that deserve respect. Just as we cannot have progress without order, we cannot have order without progress. And so as we commit to order tonight, let us commit to progress.
You know, it's interesting because I was noticing in another one of your articles, you wrote that in 1962, Nixon had told Ebony magazine that it would be foolish and a violation of GOP principles to give up on black voters. And yet, in his very nomination address in 68, he had to refute allegations that he was running a racist campaign.
Right. And part of this goes to show you just how quickly political transformations happen. So black voters support Nixon, and about a third of the black electorate supports him in the 1960 campaign. By 1968, they are turning away from him. They are rejecting him in full, in part because of his reaction to the urban disorder, to the urban riots of the 1960s, to his reaction to the Kerner Commission on Civil Disorders, which he calls basically, you know, a load of garbage. And when he begins to suggest this idea of law and order and repression and the way that he is talking about protesters and rioters, that alienates a considerable amount of African Americans. You add on to that that he has now had backroom dealings with Strom Thurmond, who becomes a Republican during this period. And black voters say this is not the man that we supported or maybe that we understood in 1960. The interesting thing about that clip that we just played is that that's actually reflects a shift in Richard Nixon's language. So before, Richard Nixon had been using this language simply of law and order. And he takes on Ed Brooke, the Massachusetts senator, who everyone in the audience should know, takes on the black Republican Massachusetts senator, who says, you cannot talk to people about law and order without adding justice. Because what is law and order if everyone is not treated equally under the law? Then that's just repression. That's why audiences think that what you're talking about is racist. So we begin to see Nixon make adjustments throughout the campaign trail towards the end of the process, although it's still not enough to actually win over a sizable portion of the black vote.
Well, do you think then that, I mean, Donald Trump, who has said he's taking a page from Nixon's campaign, that he could effectively make the same adjustments?
Well, those are adjustments that he could make, but it would also involve talking about what justice actually means. And so in the present day, when many African Americans, right, recent polling by Gallup and by Pew have shown that many African Americans believe that they are discriminated under the law, that the justice system is not equal, that Donald Trump would actually have to address this and address it in a nuanced way, mm-hmm. right? So it couldn't just be kind of flat or superficial rhetoric, but instead would actually have to address the very issues and through policies that African Americans are talking about and that they're interested in.
Right. I mean, I wish we had another half hour to talk with you because I'd love to talk to you about Ronald Reagan and his sort of conflicted record on race. I mean, he was the politician who brought us the quote unquote welfare queen. About George W. Bush, who, you know, he was I think the last Republican who actively talked about the big tent, you know, but yet he also had. He, you know, before the NAACP in 2000, when he was running for the White House, he had that famous line about the soft bigotry of low expectations. There's so much to talk about in terms of how the GOP talks about issues that are important about African Americans, first of all, about them, and then about issues that are important to them. And I want to reiterate that we're not putting a halo on the Democratic Party. It's just they're not our focus today.
That's a separate conversation.
But you've also written about how efforts amongst Black Republicans themselves from within the party in terms of warning against the shift and warning against the cost that it would or the toll that it would take on the GOP to lose Black voters in the manner that they have been. And to that effect, I wanted to play a little bit of tape from former Secretary of State and General Colin Powell. And this is from back in 2013 when he spoke with David Gregory on NBC's Meet the Press. And at the time, he was reacting very strongly to some of the language he was hearing other politicians, Republican politicians, talking about when they spoke about President Obama. And here he is again, Colin Powell, 2013.
When I see a former governor say that the president is shucking and jiving, that's a racial era slave term. When I see another former governor after the president's first debate where he didn't do very well, says that the president was lazy. He didn't say he was slow, he was tired, he didn't do well. He said he was lazy. Now, it may not mean anything to most Americans, but to those of us who are African Americans, the second word is shiftless, and then there's a third word that goes along with it. Birther, the whole birther movement. Why do senior Republican leaders tolerate this kind of discussion within the party?
Now, your book is full of African American members of the GOP. And I think Colin Powell maybe is the most recently memorable and well-known of them, who have repeatedly tried to say, we're losing the Black vote and we need to do something to change that. Why is it that you think that every time a primary comes around, that message seems to fall on deaf ears?
So I think there's very much a constant soul searching within the Republican Party, a kind of sorting out of identity. And there's this real belief, I think, within at least elite circles, official circles, strategists, that in order to win over the base, in order to shore up the base, all of our efforts have to be against, right, these other groups, these other big tent groups. So there's a lot of conversation about how this is a zero-sum game and the type of outreach that we would have to do in order to win over, say, Black or Latino voters is the kind of thing that would drive away the base of our support.
So let me ask you about that, because you yourself write that African Americans are the most partisan group of Americans in the country. I mean, to that effect, has that, I mean, this is in 2016, has that potentially harmed them? I mean, if that's one of the reasons that's propelling the extreme rhetoric that we hear in the primaries?
So it has and it hasn't. So this is the tough question, right?
Which I asked with 25 seconds left to go.
So the short answer is this is the common criticism that is launched from people on the left, on the right, which is that one party, when you are this partisan, one party will take you for granted, the other party ignores you. The other thing, though, is that being this partisan actually gives African Americans a block vote that allows them to dictate the terms of presidential elections. So it's a little bit of a mixed bag.
Well, we'll have you on. I look forward to having you on again to talk more deeply about the aspects that we didn't touch and this election
It
continues.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me on.
Leah Wright-Ragour, she's a historian and professor at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government and author of The Loneliness of the Black Republican. Thanks again.
Thanks for having me.
That's it for today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.